The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello there, everybody, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more. This week, we're going to talk with contributor Scott Gold, who also sometimes hosts this podcast, about the new Disney Plus series Star Wars Skeleton Crew, which has concluded its first season run kind of quietly. It was a Star Wars show and kind of snuck under the radar, which is in itself a cultural phenomenon that is worth discussing, and Scott and I will discuss it at length. But first, I'm going to talk to Book and Film Globe contributor Jillian Garr about a great piece she wrote for us about the films of 1975, which remain culturally relevant and entertaining to this day, 50 years down the road. And Jillian will be here to talk with me about the films of 1975 right after this interlude. I hate to break it to you all, but 1975 was 50 years ago. 50 years ago. I was alive in 1975. I wasn't going to the movies much. I was only 5 years old. If they were showing Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. But other than that, I wasn't going to the movies. But I have seen a lot of movies from 1975 since then. It was an amazing year for movies. And we have an amazing piece about the movies from the year 1975. Jillian Garr wrote it for us. And I liked it so much, I invited her on the podcast to talk to me about it. Hello, Jillian.
Hello. It's great to be back.
Yeah, so it's nice to talk to you as well. So your piece is great because it's not just about like kind of, when you think about the movies of the 70s, right, it's like quality films, right? Quality films for adults compared to today's blockbuster era. But what I loved about your piece was that it talked about how, you know, there were genre movies coming out in 1975 as well. And you covered that extremely well, I thought.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it was a fun piece to dig into. I wasn't quite sure where it was going to go when I started, but then I thought, you know, I need to get this angle in and I need to get that angle in, and it just expanded. So I'm glad I had the length to do that in.
Okay, so, but I wanted to talk about the quality movies before we get to some of the genre stuff. Like, I looked at Oscar nominees from 1975, and for some reason it brought up 1974 and 1975, because you had movies that came out in 74 and were nominated in 75, and then movies that came out in 75 and were nominated in 76. But, you know, you had 1975, the best picture was The Godfather Part II. You know, possibly the, you know, one of the five best American movies ever made. But then you had other movies in the mix, like, you know, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Robert Altman's Nashville and The Conversation and Jaws and Chinatown, you know, Dog Day Afternoon. I mean, these are movies that many of which are very, very watchable now. I mean, very watchable and are still quite popular.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, all those films you just named are considered classics now.
Not only classics, but, you know, there are lots of movies that, you know, you turn on Turner Classic Movies and you're like, well, okay, this is an old movie that used to be popular, right? But I you know, no one's going to watch The Godfather Part II or Jaws or Chinatown now and think, well, this is dated, you know? Not really.
That's a good point.
You know, you're going to look at it and think, like, this is a great movie. Or even, like, you know, you focus real heavily in your piece on Robert Altman's Nashville, which is one of my very favorite movies, one of the best movies ever made. And yeah, it's a product of its time, right? It certainly is like a post-Watergate, post-Vietnam chronicle of American decline and paranoia. But it's also a great movie about country music.
Yeah, and I know one thing I didn't get in the piece was how they had the actors write their own country songs, which I guess tweaked some noses in Nashville, because those songwriters thought, well, we should have written those songs because we know them. But you know, I think that was a clever move on Altman's part. And it just gave, you know, more insight into the characters. Once you realize the person performing that really did write that song, the way their character would have been writing their own songs.
Those songs are great too. I mean, yeah, Keith Carradine's I'm Easy won the Oscar for best song, and as well as should have. It's just such a great song, right?
Well, you know, Nashville got all these nominations, but it was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest's year. So they really didn't, I think there might have been one other award that Nashville won, but you know, they really didn't get very many for what an important film it was. And yeah, certainly that's a great song.
Yeah. And you know, I love that movie, and I could do a whole segment just on Nashville alone. But you mentioned when we were talking about this, that you rewatched The Godfather Part Two. And you know, again, like that just, that holds up so incredibly well.
Well, I watched one as well. I thought a set came into my hands through some means or other with 1, 2, and 3. And I did not watch 3, I shall note. But 1 and 2, which I hadn't seen in a while. And I was thinking, oh, that could be, there's a friend of mine that poses questions online about which of these songs do you prefer? Just kind of a fun thing. And I thought, well, which would be the better film, Godfather 1 or 2?
I like it when they show them both together in sort of chronological order on AMC, where they kind of mix them up, and it works extremely well. They work as individual films, and they work as a set as well, as sort of a merged set. It's a rare situation. And also, but let's talk about this, right? Like 1975 was this bridge year in cinema, right? It was the ultimate bridge year between quality film revolution that started, let's say, with Bonnie and Clyde and went up until 1975. And then, you know, sort of the first year of the blockbuster era, because you have Jaws that comes out that year. Jaws, which was like just completely turned the industry on its head. But, you know, when I think about Jaws, like, you know, you rewatch Jaws and you're like, okay, yes, this is a blockbuster movie about a man hunting a shark. but it also, like, it has some of that sort of gritty verite quality that that people love about 70s films, right?
Yeah. Well, obviously, unexpectedly touched a nerve because it just went on to earn so many gazillions. But a friend of mine had read my piece and he was talking to me about it. And he said he'd never seen Jaws, but his sister had. And she was living in Chicago at the time. And she said she had nightmares for weeks. And, you know, she's in Chicago. She's not really near the open sea where she's going to be encountering any sharks.
My wife said, you know, her parents took her to see it when she was like 5 or 6 years old. And she couldn't even go in a swimming pool.
Yeah, that's something my parents would never have done. My parents were great film buffs and they took me to a lot of things. I mean, they took me to Kurosawa's Throne of Blood. But then my dad woke me up at like 4 a.m. to see Them on a television. It's a movie about giant ants.
Oh, I know. I showed that to my son.
But you know, they wouldn't have taken me to something as violent as Jaws at age 5.
Yeah, I didn't see it when I was a kid. I didn't see that until much later. But you know, the point is, like, I didn't get me at an age where I had been traumatized by it. But but the idea that like that is your blockbuster because it's so. I mean, yes, it is an adaptation of a pulpy airport novel. You know, Peter Benchley's Jaws was an airport novel before it became a Steven Spielberg film. But it's not. You compare it to what our blockbusters look like now, and it's, you know, the Bruce the Shark is very visceral, but he's obviously like not CGI. You know, and so it's got some grit. You know, there's like long scenes of like guys talking on the boat. You know, it's not like it's constantly assaulting you with effects.
Well, that's what gets so tiring in modern movies, and that even if they're not that long, to me they seem long because they just have to pile effect onto explosion onto this and that, and you know, I start looking at my watch or you know, how soon can I get out of here?
We're right at the top of your piece. You talk about how you know the movies that topped the charts in 2024, which was the last full year of film releases we could consider, right? You know, it includes like Wonka, Sonic the Hedgehog 3, Inside Out 2, Deadpool and Wolverine, Kung Fu Panda 4, you know, And, you know, it's just this endless stream of intellectual property. You know, some of those movies were entertaining, but then you compare it to what was like people were going to see in 1975, like Dog Day Afternoon and Shampoo, 3 Days of the Condor. And then you talk about what I thought was so interesting in your piece is like you talk about the genre movies of that era, like The Stepford Wives. And you give a lot of time and attention to Norman Jewison's Rollerball.
Yeah, that was like the seed of the piece for me because I wanted to see the movie again. And I hadn't seen it in quite some time. And I was really taken with how exciting the rollerball matches are, because you see three of them in the film and just how well they're put together. So this time I listened to the director's commentary and that was interesting as well. And it just, he explained some of the editing tricks he used because he really didn't want to make it too explicitly violent. So he said he did things like adding sound or doing an edit so it looked like a body hit was worse than it was. But I guess what I found most fascinating was that he wanted it to be a critique of how we celebrate violence as entertainment, particularly in sport. But instead, it got people excited about the game of rollerball.
Right. And they tried to start actual rollerball leagues.
Yeah, they said, hey, we should do this for real. So he was somewhat dismayed. But, you know, to speak to something that you said earlier about films being dated, another thing he said when he was putting the film together was the use of music. But he said he didn't want to use like futuristic styled music because that would date. In 20 years when you hear it, then, you know, oh yeah, that's obviously the 70s or the 80s or whatever era you recognize that music as being from. So he used a lot of classical music.
That's a trick they used to do. That's the trick they used to use in the 70s. Like they used classical music in Soylent Green, if you remember, you know, which is a film actually in some ways that Rollerball reminds me of. It's like the 70s, it was in the late 60s, early 70s, there were a lot of these sort of dystopias, these kind of grim dystopias. I consider Rollerball to be that's a pretty grim movie.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it looks like everybody is well taken care of, other like in comparison to Soylent Green, where they're all starving to death. But there was another scene that really struck me when the players are at this party attended by all the elites and the rich folks. And for fun, they go outside and they blow up trees.
Yeah. And that, you know, again, that's the kind of detail that you're not necessarily going to get in a contemporary movie, right? They actually take the time to have a scene where that happens.
And they don't, you know, the director has enough confidence in the audience's intelligence that he doesn't feel he has to explain it. Like there isn't a scene where, you know, someone takes the flamethrower out and blows up a tree and they don't cut to someone saying, oh, that's too bad that we're destroying those trees because we're bored. You know, they don't spoon feed it to you that way.
Right.
He assumes you can understand the point he's making without overemphasizing it.
So here's what you have in 1975. Right? You have like quality classics that can be played, that could be playing in another 50 years. You have an interesting array of genre films. You have this sort of pivot to the blockbuster. You know, Jaws was the fulcrum on which the entire movie industry, I mean, I guess you could say it really turned when Star Wars came out, but Jaws was the first, you know, the first big blockbuster. And then you also had, like, you know, it's 1975 and you had some, like, you know, weird cult pictures that came out that, you know, continue to resonate today. I hadn't realized it. It hadn't occurred to me that, like, the Rocky Horror Picture Show is from 1975. And so is Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Right, right.
Both these movies, in different ways, continue to have a long life. I still watch Monty Python and the Holy Grail on a fairly regular basis, and it continues to be funny. It was so good that, in fact, Eric Idle adapted it into a hit Broadway musical, and so it just continues to resonate. And then, you know, of course, Rocky, people still to this day, you know, dress up and go to their midnight screenings of the Rocky Horror Picture Show and do the thing. People who were not even remotely close to born when the movie came out.
I do have a hard time understanding because when I saw Rocky in the 70s, and yes, I went and dressed up and did all that. But at that time, it was something, you know, new and different and kind of transgressive. And so if I was like 18 or 19 today, Rocky now, it just seems kind of so conventional. I wouldn't want to go and dress up now. I'd be doing whatever is going to be the new thing in a few years, you know, seeking out something new. So I'm kind of curious as to why young people that, you know, 20, late teens, early 20s, why they're doing
it. Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I mean, who's to say, you know, why anybody does anything? But I think that it's interesting that, you know, I feel like in some ways, given what we've listed, like the movies of 1975 have as much resonance as movies of 1985 or 1995. Like that year is still very much, that year of movies is very much with us. And if you read your piece, you're like, hey, you know, this is relevant. And for instance, like 50 years before 1975 was 1925, right? I mean, there is nothing alive culturally from 1925 in 1975. Nothing. Not a single thing. The mediums were completely different, and the sensibilities and the tastes were completely different. And yet we live in an era where, you know, the stuff that came out 50 years ago, at least the movies, I don't know so much about the TV shows, can still feel as, well, yeah, you know, we had this movie this year that celebrated the 50th anniversary of Saturday Night Live, right? And it still feels to some extent fresh and relevant. Like you have, like, that year is still very much with us. And it's kind of a bizarre phenomenon, I think.
You know, I just looked it up out of curiosity because you were saying 1925. And so The Phantom of the Opera came out in 1925. The Lon Chaney version.
Okay, sure, great. You know, yes, and you know, I'm sure that everyone knows what Lon Chaney's to the Phantom of the Opera looks like, but no one's watching it. I'm just saying, like, you know, obviously it's a very, it, you know, there weren't even talking pictures yet, so it's like it's not really a fair comparison. But I just think about that sometimes, like, you know, my son still listens to 80s music. And, you know, I was not, with maybe the rare exception of like an old Frank Sinatra cut, listening to music of the 1940s, you know, back in the day. So it's just a very strange and interesting phenomenon. And you wrote a not strange, but very interesting piece about the films of 1975. And that you can read that on Book and Film Globe. So Jillian Garr, I assume that for next year, we're going to have a films of 1976 piece.
Well, that's a thought. I'll have to start looking it up now.
Rocky was the best picture that year.
That's kind of, yeah, more towards the blockbuster era.
Yes, we're inching toward the blockbuster era, having really started 50 years ago. My God.
You know, though, what's interesting about Rocky, the first one anyway, is that he loses the match.
I know, right?
So, which, you know, that's a bold, gutsy move that you can't really imagine them doing today.
Right, like the Creed movies, the modern Creed never loses. The good guy can't lose. Anyway, but in the 70s, the good guy lost all the time. Jillian Garr's terrific piece about the films of 1975 is on Book and Film Globe right now. Jillian, we'll talk to you either later this year or in 50 years. We'll see how it goes.
I hope I'm here. Hope I'm able to talk in 50 years.
Yeah, we'll be like the films of 2025.
Well, back when...
Back when we watched things with our eyes.
A crew of murderous pirates is coming. We have to hurry. Are you listening to any of this?
We're listening.
Oh yeah, what did I just say?
Are you listening to any of this?
Let's go!
You wanted to search the buffet.
We're not searching the buffet!
So I have frequent contributor Scott Gold here in the cockpit. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Neil. Good to be back.
Yeah. So you said to me a few weeks ago, we were talking about things you could write about for Book and Film Globe. And you said, well, I want to write about Skeleton Crew. And I said, what's Skeleton Crew? And you said, well, it's this new Star Wars show. And I said, you know, and we pretty much write about anything related to Star Wars on the website. And it just got me thinking, like, There was a new Star Wars show on Disney Plus, and I didn't even know about it. I mean, can you imagine, Scott? Like, you know, when we even any time in our lives people wouldn't know that there was new Star Wars content.
It is absolutely unfathomable to me that, like, there's a new live action Star Wars television show, huge budget, spaceships, the whole deal. And it's starring Jude Law and a bunch of kids. And people just are like, wait, what? That's happening? Like, the idea that people didn't know that there's a new Star Wars, I think, is a testament to the fact that we have so much Star Wars now, as opposed to how it was back in the, you know, like in the 80s and I guess the 90s up until the prequels were released. The idea of any new Star Wars that wasn't like a novel or a comic book was just a beautiful dream. And now it's happening all the time. And I got to say, I ain't sad.
Well, look, you're not sad, but let's be clear. A lot of the Star Wars content, I think one of the reasons why people weren't talking about Skeleton Crew is because a lot of it has been bad, particularly the last show. I mean, I know we talked about The Acolyte, which is the last Star Wars show to come out on this podcast. We talked about it kind of early in its run, and we were kind of giving it a wide berth. But let's face it, that show was it was such a turkey that I put it on my worst TV of 2024 list. It ended up being so lousy. You know, shows like Obi-Wan Kenobi and The Book of Boba Fett, that was some pretty rank TV that Star Wars has turned out. I mean, there's also been some legendary TV, like the first season of The Mandalorian and Andor. But there's been some bad stuff. That said, Skeleton Crew is a delight. I mean, my wife and I watched the whole 8-episode season in 3 days.
It is, and that was the adjective that I was going to employ as well. It's delightful, which is something we haven't seen in Star Wars in a really long time. So, like, having a Star Wars that's just pure fun and a little bit different in the fact that it stars and it's really about a group of children is a little bit different, and it doesn't take itself too seriously. In fact, there's a lot of in-joking and a little bit of goofiness, but not the kind of Jar Jar Binks goofiness that's just kind of like, you know, like eye-rolling goofiness, but just genuine kid kind of stuff. And it was really, really refreshing and fun. I thought, you know, going forward with Star Wars, it was like a nice Star Wars cantina sorbet to just like cleanse your palate of all of the questionable recipes that they've used in the past.
Yeah, you know, it was fun and funny. It had a lot of heart. But there was lots of swashbuckling adventure and, you know, great action set pieces and, you know, really fun, hammy performance at the center with Jude Law as the, we'll call him the hero, anti-hero, villain, whatever you want to refer to him as. I don't want to spoil anything for people, but, you know, he certainly held the screen. And other adult actors, you know, Kerry Condon, Oscar nominee Kerry Condon, Kelly MacDonald is in this thing, you know, and, you know, only for, I think, one episode, but she had a lot of vigor in her role. She chewed it up underneath her weird makeup. And the whole thing is just fun, right? So the story basically involves these four kids who discover a spaceship. They live on this planet that is hidden from the rest of the galaxy for reasons that we don't really quite understand why it's hidden. But they escape and they end up like finding adventure out there in the broad universe. That is the essential premise, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's especially for fans of a certain age, certainly ones who grew up with Star Wars in the 80s and 90s, there are homages galore to, child-led series. Like, obviously, The Goonies is the one that everybody's talking about, and I used it in my headline. But also, you know, great stories like Explorers, which is one that I think is often forgot, had a young River Phoenix and Ethan Hawke, who they basically just build a spaceship in their backyard and go to space. Also a little bit of Flight of the Navigator, another kid discovering a spaceship, and of course Space Camp, the last
Starfighter, which is technically about a teenager, but it still had that same like suburban American youth rocketing into space idea. Yeah, that's the thing, is like these kids live on a, like as you put it out in your review, they live in essentially like a suburb.
Yes, a Star Wars suburb, 1970s Southern California, right down to the, you know, the architecture and the fact that it's always, you know, somehow magic hour, just right out of the 70s, 80s Steven Spielberg playbook. And it was a literal homage to E.T., like the neighborhood that the kids live in there, like right down to they're riding speeder bikes and around the neighborhood. And it's just
And they all have money. Everyone has money.
Oh, yeah.
They have lots of money.
They definitely have money. There was Chekhov's golden credit chips that were given to one of the kids as lunch money.
Yeah.
They were like, okay, that doesn't seem like regular lunch money. And then of course they find out when the first place they find themselves trying to make their way back to their home planet is a little pirate outpost. And all of a sudden they realize, maybe the place they come from is maybe a little bit different than what they thought it was.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I loved about the kid, look, I wouldn't say any of these four kids. Well, first of all, three of them are actual kids. One of them is an elephant boy named Neil. that's the Neil in Star Wars. It's like, it was not based on me. His little tuft of blue hair is not. And that's about as much hair as I have these days. But no, it was not. I do like taking bubble baths, just like Neil does. But you know, they're. I wouldn't say any of them are particularly great actors, but they're game, and they have like a nice kind of gee whiz spirit about them. They go to these incredibly dangerous and grimy places, and they're just like, okay, here we are. We're having an adventure. Sometimes they, you know, they seem a little stressed, but they're always confident that they're going to get out of it.
Yeah, and you know, the one thing I also really loved about it is they. You know, Star Wars has a long history of, you know, depicting the child as like the sidekick or the adorable scamp, always in service to
or the chosen one,
in service to the adult characters, and never fully fleshed out and realized as people in their own right. And I think that's something that Skeleton Crew really got right, which is important because you have to care about these kids and the fact that they're in danger. And, you know, there's also, you know, some nice side stories about the parents who are obviously very eager to get their children back from space. And they have to plot against, you know, the droid society that kind of runs their planet in order to try and send an illegal contact beacon out into space. So there's like a fun little parallel storyline there. And the adult cast does a lovely job as well.
But they don't overdo it. And I also thought, I mean... There's two showrunners for the show. One of them is John Watts, who did the Spider-Man movies for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I don't remember the name of the other one at the moment, but they employed some big name Hollywood directors for this. I mean, the Daniels, who won the Oscar for Everything Everywhere All at Once, directed an episode. And Lee Isaac Chung, who directed Minari, which is an Oscar-nominated film, and last summer's Twisters. Directed an episode. Bryce Dallas Howard is always active in these shows. So it's like they have this stable. So there's genuine cinematic talent at work here.
Oh, absolutely. And it shows, but at the same time, like there's talent, but it's not, you know, as Peter Griffin would say, it doesn't insist upon itself. Like it's just working hard in the background and allowing the story to kind of unfold on its own. And it's not like overly distracting, like, look how great we are at cinematography.
No.
It just feels like a really great, fun story that we can kind of get caught up in. And, you know, it's I don't think it's anything that, you know, people are going to be thinking about as maybe peak Star Wars as far as the entire franchise is concerned. But at the same time, it's just really good, fun Star Wars. And yes. I just love the Treasure Island aspect, the pirates. And there have been pirates in Star Wars for a long time. We saw a bit of it with Hondo in the Clone Wars, and he's a fan favorite character. But of course, that was animated. And so to have like literally a pirate adventure, like replete with like all the swashbuckling and the swords and the costumes and the gold and the hunt for treasure. And literally instead of, you know, like walking the plank, they have, you know, they would push people out of an airlock. And that sense of danger and roguishness is very real. And it's a trope that exists in literature and TV and films for, you know, centuries for a reason. Like it's compelling storytelling. And so the fact that they tapped into it in a way that was really effective made the show a lot of fun.
Agreed. It's very clever. And let's not leave without mentioning Nick Frost's droid, character, who is extremely funny and entertaining in this.
Sort
of a broken down pirate droid who has like 18 different personalities. I don't remember what his name. I don't remember what his name was. You know,
his name is SM33, and it took me a hot second before it. I had a light bulb moment, and I said, "Wait a second! His name is literally Smee, like right from Peter Pan."
Oh my gosh! Yeah, that's right. And Jude Law is basically Captain Hook.
Yeah, Captain Hook, or like one of his aliases is Captain Silva. Little, you know, again, Long John Silver, yes. Captain Silva. Like it's not, you know, it's not a stretch to put those things together, right? That was intentional. And it's fun. Like those kind of Easter eggs, like all of the loving homages to the entire genre, you know, pirates in space. Like, come on, how is that not fun? And that sense of fun is something that is missing sometimes in Star Wars.
It has been missing. It has. It could have been terrible. You know, it could have been a total dirge, but this is just, to my mind, it's excellent popcorn entertainment. It's excellent genre filmmaking, and it's really good. It's a really, I don't know, like, I didn't watch it with my whole family. My whole family is basically like my wife, my dog, and I at this point. Like, you know, my son is off doing his own thing, but, you know, if we'd had tweens or, you know, 9-year-olds, it would have been a great show for the whole family to watch together.
Oh, absolutely. And it balances really well with, you know, the very grim, dour, kind of Cold War-ish John le Carré nature of a series like Andor, which is peak Star Wars, but it's also very dark and kind of stressful and dramatic in the very intense ways in that, like, it's very, you know, you don't know who's going to live, you don't know who's going to die, and this is not that. It's like kind of the polar opposite of that, but that doesn't mean that it's any worse. It's just very different in the form of entertainment it is.
Very totally different. Yeah, Andor is like Star Wars as quality TV, and Skeleton Crew is Star Wars as classic 80s young adult blockbuster TV.
Absolutely. And going back even further, I would say it's very similar to like the old Saturday morning like TV serials.
Yeah. Which were huge influences on filmmakers like George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. So it makes sense that another generation of filmmakers is sort of circling back toward that. So I guess what Scott and I are saying here is that Skeleton Crew is good and it's fun and you should watch it.
Absolutely. 100%.
All right. Scott, you can go shoot anybody who disagrees with us out the airlock now.
Oh, sounds great. I'm on it.
All right. Thanks a lot, Scott Gold. Star Wars Skeleton Crew is now airing on Disney+. Scott is our man for all things science fiction and all things Star Wars, and we'll be hearing from him very soon in the near future. Also, thanks to Julian Garr for talking to me about the films of 1975. You should just transport yourself back in time to 1975 and go to the movies. You can go to the movies every day and you'll always see something entertaining in the past and in the present, for that matter. You should go to the movies. You should watch movies. You should watch TV. You should read books. You should engage in the culture. The culture goes on, and we cover it at Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. Thank you so much for reading the site, and thank you so much for listening to the show. I will talk to you very soon.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with 2 locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at the Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's the Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.